Blog Talk Radio.
Hey guys, it is Thursday, September 26th, and I am here with Steve Poynton with Slow News Day. Hey Steve. Oh wait, I gotta unmute you.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
All right. Well, how are you doing? Thank you
welcome.
For having me on.
I'm doing great. Thank you for coming on. You've been busy today. Oh my gosh.
Well, I got a text from my boss at 5:30 in the morning saying that we had the day off because he had a doctor's appointment that he had forgotten about. So I decided to make up for some lost time. I haven't been able to do a live stream since, I think, Sunday.
Wow.
So I'm, I've still got like a dozen things I'd like to cover that I'm just not going to have time for.
Well, for listeners not familiar with Slow News Day, Steve has a channel on YouTube, and it's one of my favorite because, Steve, you stream all the time. So I actually get the notifications, and if I don't get them on YouTube, I get them on Twitter because I follow you. And so, I'll just click over and keep that playing while I'm doing something else. And it's really cool because it's laid back, you know, it's like just talking to somebody on your porch, you know, it's the same kind of conversation. And I think that that's, I think we need more of that actually. Plus you talk about really important stuff. And today's news is full of, wow, all kinds of tasty bits. Like, earlier you were talking about whistleblowing, and since then there's been this big cancel New York Times thing about how supposedly they quote unquote outed a whistleblower when in reality nobody was named. Basically what they did was they put out an article that was what they were trying to do, which I think is just so glaringly clear, is they were trying to prop up his bona fides. And they were trying to say, well, because this guy's in the CIA and he's an analyst, the analyst by training has made clear he was steeped in the details of American foreign policy towards Europe, demonstrating a sophisticated understanding of Ukrainian politics and at least some knowledge of the law. So, I mean, like what they were doing was, you know, saying, believe this guy because he has all these credentials.
Right, right. And believe him because, you know, CIA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't question the CIA. And as a matter of fact, they even say that there's the executive editor of the New York Times in a separate statement said that the Times was right to publish the information about the whistleblower. This is after the blowback. And he said, quote, the role of the whistleblower, including his credibility and his place in the government, is essential to understanding one of the most important issues facing the country, whether the president of the United States abused power, blah, blah, blah. But that word understanding is essential to understanding. What they meant to say there was essential to believing our story here on this.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I think it was the other day, Jimmy Dore was doing a live stream, and he was quick to point out that whatever Mockingbird Media he was referring to, the host said he had learned that this happened. And what that means is the CIA told us their version of events that we are going to report without question, or that we are going to parrot without question. And this is the exact same thing going on. They're predetermining consent.
Right. They're manufacturing it. And we talk about that a lot. We talk about manufacturing consent, and you say manufacturing. Is it confusion?
Confusion, yeah, because Chomsky wrote manufacturing consent 30 years ago. Consent has been manufactured. And by predetermining consent in terms of, you know, relating it to you are going to go ahead and accept this information from the CIA agent because look at all the bona fides he has, that's reasserting that the consent has already been manufactured. What the media needs to do now is keep us perpetually confused, perpetually distracted. More often than not, given enough time, they will contradict themselves at a rate that is grotesquely obvious to anybody paying attention. But that's the point. The point is to keep people distracted from one thing to the next so that they don't stop and think and put one and two together.
Right, right, exactly.
That's what
exactly
I try to do through the show, is point that out.
Well, and I think that it's that you're really successful in doing that. And part of what I like is when you broadcast, when you go live, you've generally got one, maybe two things to talk about, but there's a focus, and you kind of segment things off so that you can, you know, watch a stream and it's 40 minutes, or watch a stream and it's 30 minutes, and it's your thought, and then you bring in the comments from the people in the chat, so that it makes it this whole kind of wraparound thing.
Well, I've always felt like as a fan of the medium of podcasting, of streaming, and of long form interviews, that the best shows occur when you're not just simply talking at people, or especially if you're trying to do it, you know, pedantically or with the smug superiority of most of the, at least the big name broadcasters. And I'm not trying to say like in the independent media world, even though if you've ever watched The Young Turks for 3 minutes, you'll see some smug people. but no, I mean, so when people shoot their show, if they don't have the full capability to, you know, pull up clips and articles and all that stuff, you always see, you know, two white walls and maybe a picture. And I intentionally don't do that. I shoot on my deck, or I shoot in a recording studio that is a converted post office that was originally the footprint of a whorehouse.
Awesome.
So I'm trying to, and it was the only whorehouse in the Santa Cruz Mountains that you had to be relatively sober walking in. It was called the Swamp House, and it's because it literally sat right across a big bog, and there was a plank that people had to walk across to get to it.
That's fabulous. You were saying the other day on a stream, or maybe it was today, that the part of California where you live is surrounded with property owned by members of the Grateful Dead, and that there was some music festivals that they were the songwriter who recently passed away yesterday.
Robert, yeah, that's actually not, that's in Mendocino County. I'm in Santa Cruz County. It's about 5.5-6 hours away. But I had lived up there and I had worked there, and that's what it is. Although there's a in the Santa Cruz Mountains, we have Bonnie Dune, where the Dead did have a cottage and a recording studio. There's also Lompico, which is where Jerry Garcia's grandparents lived, and that's where the finger got cut.
Oh.
So Jerry's missing finger is somewhere up in Lompico Hills.
So you might say that a part of Jerry Garcia will always be in those hills.
Absolutely.
So, on this whistleblower thing today, you know, the other thing that you do, and that sometimes I hop on and give whatever help or content that I have that I can is Action for Assange, and you know, just the whole Assange thing just annoys me right now. So like I have a really hard time with the received wisdom, you know, that manufactured wisdom that WikiLeaks was 100% responsible and that the Russian government was responsible for giving the DNC email leaks to WikiLeaks. And it's something that I've written about a lot and something that I've talked about a lot is that's not proven. It's an allegation. And it's one of those things that intelligence services have tried really hard to make people believe. And to a large extent, they've been successful doing that. And so, you know, Julian Assange is a publisher for whistleblowers. And right now, Chelsea Manning has been in back in federal prison for refusing to comply with, you know, to buckle under their pressure to snitch on people. They also got, oh my gosh, now I'm forgetting his name. The other guy who was connected Jeremy Hammond, connected to the Barrett Brown stuff.
So let's talk about this for a minute, and I'm gonna pull up the exact number for Chelsea. Julian Assange has been illegally and arbitrarily detained for nearly 3,300 days.
Wow.
From the time that he went to the embassy to where he currently is in Belmarsh Prison, which has been nicknamed the UK's Guantanamo Bay, where he is in solitary up to 22 or 23 hours a day, where his doctor visits are being set at the same time that he would be allowed one of his two monthly hour-long visits with his lawyers or his relatives. His doctor's appointments are being scheduled around, lawyer visits. He only recently was allowed access to the hundreds and thousands of postcards and letters that supporters have been sending him over the last several months.
Wow.
According to Nels Milzer, the UN Rapporteur on Torture, Julian Assange is currently and has been being tortured, both psychologically and physically, because again, if you're in an embassy for 9 years, you are very limited to what you can do in terms of exercise. There's a video of him on a skateboard missing. And the psychological torture is 100% intentional. They are absolutely trying to destroy this man, just as they are trying to destroy Chelsea Clinton, who is now 197 days in jail. She is up to $88,000 in fines. And these are fines imposed to break her. The judge has to let her out if he concedes that more time and more punitive fines won't break her. Chelsea and her lawyers have made it perfectly clear that she is not going to walk into a perjury trap, because that is exactly what her detention is. They are hoping that she will utter one word out of place different from her original testimony in 2013, which they have. Brooke, they have it.
Mm-hmm.
All they have to do is read it. But they want, again, this is something Julian Assange has termed punishment as process. And the same with Jeremy Hammond. He was in a relatively low security prison in Oklahoma. He was part of the Global Intelligence Files and Stratfor leaks. He is now transferred to the exact same jail as Chelsea Manning. They're calling him in. ahead of this extradition hearing that is set for February 25th in London for Julian Assange. Over 18 charges, one of which doesn't even concern him, but he's being charged with it anyway. 18 charges that are 100% built on a house of lies.
And yet there he is. Even though all of this is a house of lies, there he is, you know, in jail. And I think that, or prison is actually a better word. And I think that it's really hard for people to understand that this is the level of authoritarianism that we're dealing with right now. That they don't have to give you a reason, that they can just lock you up if they don't like what you're saying. And I was listening in on Action for Assange, I think it was yesterday, when you guys were talking about the suspension or the timeout for using hashtags on Twitter. Just basically for talking about issues having to do with Julian Assange, Unity for Jay, Action for Assange, using those hashtags where you're sharing information and you're sharing news about whistleblowers, that in itself has become an actionable, I don't know, you know, reason for them to, you know, lock you down for 24 hours or however long they do. What was all of that about?
So September 22nd, Sunday, was the day that Julian Assange should have been released from a ridiculous bail warrant, bail jumping warrant. They were charging him with absconding from going to face trial in Sweden over charges that were never officially brought. They were, you know, they opened an investigation, they closed the investigation, they reopened the investigation, they closed the investigation, but there were never actually charges brought against him. And Julian Assange said, I will go and I will meet the Swedish government on behalf of this, you know, and answer their questions about this investigation if you can guarantee me that this is not just a set up for me to walk in and be extradited to the United States over the Afghanistan war logs, which he knew at that point the U.S. had already drawn up a secret warrant to arrest him.
Mm-hmm.
So Sweden would not make him that guarantee. The U.K. would not make him that guarantee. So he sought asylum at the Ecuadorian embassy and was granted asylum by the country of Ecuador. So there is no, at that point, there's no absconding charge. Okay? It would be incumbent upon both the government of Sweden and the government of the United Kingdom to drop those charges. But here we are, because there is no justice when it comes to reporting on the crimes of empire, clearly. Here we are. We're September 22nd. Julian Assange was supposed to be released. They have kind of the same program as you get credit for like a day and a half or 2 days for each day you serve, like we do here in the States. So he was sentenced to, I believe, 10 months. This would have been five. Five in a week or something like that. And so throughout the Twitter sphere, the Assange community, the community that's supportive of WikiLeaks, whistleblowers in general, was raising awareness about that, as we do, because it's a ridiculous notion now, and it is a clear designation that Julian Assange is a political prisoner. He went to court on the 13th of September. The judge preemptively denied him bail for when he was going to be released a week later. They hadn't even covered that yet. She preemptively denies him bail, announcing to the world that Julian Assange is officially, without question, a political prisoner. So on the 22nd, Christy Dopp, who's the United States spokeswoman for Unity for Jay, which is an organization that formed in response to Julian Assange being cut off from the internet at the embassy and being denied all communication whatsoever, she was tweeting out about this, and she was using the hashtags Free Assange and WikiLeaks and a couple others, and Twitter suspended her account. They gave her no email notifying her of it. They gave her no reason for it. It took 48 hours before they contacted her to tell her that she was basically, it was like an egregious use of hashtag in a way that that didn't correlate with any information, which is complete and total crap. So she, I quite literally was censored for raising awareness in the exact fashion that one would go about were they wanting to raise awareness. She was censored for activism.
Right. I'm looking at her timeline now. So she was out for, it looks like, 2 days. Mm-hmm. And the 22nd would have been 4 days ago. So I'm looking through the tweets, and every single one of these are, every single one is different. There's retweets. There's all kinds of unique news items. There's unique call to actions. And when I see this and I hear this particular, you know, hear about this particular thing that happened, you know, I'm reminded you can't click on anything that's trending on Twitter without finding those Korean, like, how come they haven't been thrown off?
Because K-pop is a pure expression of capitalism, Brooke. That's why.
Exactly. Yeah, seriously. I mean, that's just true. That's just 100%. There you go. That's the reason.
So Christy responds to this and says, you know, will you please let me know exactly which tweets cross the line? Because A, you're supposed to, and B, I'm genuinely curious, and explain to me how, you know, this charge that you're this accusation or my reason for suspension has any merit. Thank you, Christy Dopp. And Twitter writes back, you're welcome, Twitter.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So, it's like they reached through the screen and slapped her.
And I just counted up all of the tweets that Christy did that were just her own 4 days ago. And there's like six or seven of them. It's not that many. She did a lot of retweets and, you know, maybe some replies. I haven't clicked on replies, but it's not that much. I mean, most people tweet, a lot of people I know can tweet a hell of a lot more than six tweets in an hour, you know?
Oh, yeah. Especially if they walked into a battle with Prop or Not.
Aren't they fun?
That was weird. That was super weird.
I know, right? So what happened is... I tweeted out something about, it was a story about how Bernie Sanders wouldn't endorse his own son in a congressional race because, you know, appearance of impropriety. And I said, let Hunter Biden put that in his crack pipe and smoke it. And so somebody, And so somebody asked, there was something about the $50,000 a month that Hunter Biden was receiving to be on the board of this Ukrainian gas company. And I said, it's actually $166,000 in total that was, you know, between Hunter Biden and then the money that was going directly to, as a transfer payment, $166,000 per month was going to the company, you know, which amounted to a $3 million payout over the course of like 16 months, 14 or 16 months. It's an ungodly amount of money. You know, it's just, it's a way to launder money. It's a way to buy politicians. And, you know, this is the Ukraine. So this is exactly how this happens. And by the way, Joe Biden happened to be the point person on Ukraine at this time, after the coup that we fomented and participated in, that overthrew a democratically elected.
Provided training and provided special ops units to go and provide, what do they call it, operational support.
Operational support to a bunch of blood and soil Nazis.
Yes.
The Maidan coup, I remember all these Occupy people being like, you know, like solidarity. And I'm like, not so fast. Those guys are freaking Nazis. They've all got the sun, what is that? The black sun tattooed on their elbows.
Yep.
And shit. Yeah, you know, these are not the right side to be on. And I thought it was really funny how Proper Not jumps in. Oh, yeah. So we're back to Proper Not. So I did a citation on that $166,000, and there's an article that Eve Smith did in Naked Capitalism way back April 9 of this year that goes over this controversy with Hunter Biden, like into the details, like all the way down, drilling all the way down. It's a fantastic article. Look for it. It's called Ukrainian Prosecutors. Why doesn't the U.S. Department of Justice want our evidence on Democrats? And of course, this is when Alexandra Chalupa, the DNC operative, was outed for, you know, soliciting dirt on Manafort and, you know, trying to get Ukraine to interfere in the United States elections. So there's just, you know, everything having to do with Ukraine is freaking dirty. So I laid that down. And the guy was like, so why should I believe this particular citation? And I said, well, they're on Proper Not's blacklist. So, you know,
right.
That's a pretty big seal of approval if you ask me. And here comes Proper Not, just like, my husband's convinced that it's just a bot, that it just responds automatically with, you know, it has a certain amount of, you know, Nazi propaganda that it throws out at you, given what keywords you lay down in a tweet. I think he might be right. At first, I thought it was probably somebody from either Daily Kos or Democratic Underground doing like a, you know, like a side band, you know, like you know, just getting some side work. But he might be right. They really could be a bot.
Well, okay, so that's a possibility. That's a possibility. What's also a possibility is that there is a Proper Not bot that responds to algorithms, but then a human being, if it warrants it, takes over. Because not even the Jared Beck AI bot responds the way that particular the way that it played out this morning. And if you go to that consortium news article where they break down who's part of Proper Not, it is all Ukrainian intelligence in the
CIA. That's right.
CrowdStrike and
members
of the digital forensics research lab that comes out of the Atlantic Council.
Hell, they're probably
all
tuned in to us right now.
I hope so. You know what? On the Free Assange vigils, we frequently say hello to whatever NSA agent is tasked with listening to us that particular evening. So I don't know why we wouldn't do now. I can't remember what our nickname for the agent was though. But yeah, I mean, you've got in prop or not, members of the Atlantic Council and members of the Broadcasting Board of Governors that that according to their own website says their mission is to inform, engage, and connect people around the world in support of freedom and democracy. Projects are Voice of America, Radio Liberty, and the Middle East Broadcasting Networks. And that is a 100% propaganda factory in the Broadcasting Board of Governors.
Well,
and by the way, they used to have a board that makes these decisions, but in 2017, it went to one singular chief executive per the NDAA.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
It's interesting, and it's also one of those things that just further corroborates and further validates the work and research and reporting of Susie Dawson.
Susie Dawson, I think, isn't well understood in a lot of progressive circles. I think that she was at the center of a tempest for a limited amount of time, and if people weren't tuned into it at the moment, they missed it. So could you give just a little bit of what Susie Dawson is about?
So Susie Dawson is a New Zealand journalist and activist who first got involved in reporting on how intelligence networks operate and spread their influence and ultimately target journalists and activists through the Occupy movement. She was heavily involved in New Zealand in that. From there, she formed the Internet Party of New Zealand, which she then, and that's how a figure like Kim.com comes into the story. She became a targeted journalist through exposing the infiltration tactics of law enforcement, both at the local and international level during Occupy.
And that's what Jeremy Hammond was doing, right? With Stratfor. Didn't he have something to do with the Stratfor release?
Yeah.
And that's the same. That was the military positioning snipers, for God's sakes, around different city occupations. I forget if this was like Houston or New York or where it was, but there was a couple. There was a handful that Stratfor was, you know, just give us the word and we'll go in, you know, and write us a check.
Yeah. Yeah, there are over 100,000 documents in the global intelligence files. But if you're listening to the show right now and you're familiar with how to read documents and cables, and you haven't looked at the Stratfor leaks, the global intelligence files, they are incredible and a decade old.
And these are WikiLeaks, right?
Yes. You can basically type in any word that you can come up with, any government that you can think of. There's the great thing about WikiLeaks, Brooke, and the great thing about Julian Assange is if you take 2 seconds to step away from the official narrative and go directly to the source, the documents, they are so easily debunked. The DNC recently had a lawsuit against them dismissed with prejudice by the judge.
Wow.
He was a Clinton-appointed judge.
Wow.
This the judge Kettle determined that WikiLeaks was a publisher just like any other, and that they had the same protections entitled to them that the outlets that printed the Pentagon Papers do, and that's cited in the judge's dismissal. But back to what I was getting at though. Because of her work exposing what she now has a new project about the Five Eyes, the intelligence sharing network between the United Kingdom, Canada, the U.S., New Zealand, and Australia. Through her work doing it, she became targeted and threatened by her own government, by our government, by the U.K. and Australia's government, and I probably Canada. But she had to flee her native country. She has been seeking asylum in Moscow. She was recently granted a review, which she will then hopefully in the next month or so be granted asylum in that country and able to again. Or I was just saying this on a live stream, answering a question about Edward Snowden. I feel that if you've been granted asylum in that country, you have the ability to move around with a little bit more freedom. And I think that it will absolutely benefit her capability to continue to publish this information that is so incredibly vital.
What did it mean for Susie Dawson when she was targeted as a journalist? What were the kind of things that they were doing? Were they threatening her with jail or what?
Everything from arrest to death and the death of her children, the death of her parent, like all of it. She was.
Wow.
She was. If you read, I mean, she's got. She got a fairly large body of work on all of this. But any of the posts that she put up on Contraspin, .nz, she breaks down in incredible detail, her experiences and how it's played out for her. And if you read, the piece freeing Julian Assange, the third part of that is basically like a how-to and survival guide for activists and how not to succumb to burnout or depression or a campaign that's being waged against you as a targeted activist. It's incredible.
I think that that's important for activists in general. I think that we don't pay enough attention to self-care. And I think that a lot of times, it's really easy just to, burn your candle at both ends, even if you're not a targeted person, if you get into the work and burn yourself out.
Well, that's absolutely right. We probably don't talk about it enough in our own right on the vigils how important self-care is. When you're in a situation where you know going in that the work that you're about to do is going to piss off a global intelligence network, you really need to make sure that you are allowing yourself time to heal and time to process and to stop and think. She has a great bit of advice in this piece in that third part of freeing Julian Assange, and it says, "How does your FBI handler want you to feel today?"
Don't let them feel that way.
Right. And so sometimes you just gotta stop and ask yourself. And I don't know if regular viewers of the show are involved in activism at that level. If they're involved in activism, there's a file on you.
Well, you know, I think that
we know that because of WikiLeaks.
Right. Right. Well, and we know that from history too. I think that there is a major disconnect. I'm ridiculously old, you know, so like I kind of came to consciousness in, you know, like 70s, you know, 70s kind of music scene, pot smoking kind of shit at the beach, you know, and everybody knew. I mean, church committee had just happened. So like everybody was aware of, you know, that the CIA and the intelligence agencies, they're not our friends. And what's going on right now with, you know, what we started out with talking about the CIA embedded whistleblower in the Trump administration, we're being taken on a ride with this shit. You know, this is all kayfabe. This is a show put on for us. If this guy was like a real whistleblower, he'd be, you know, hung up by his ankle somewhere. You know, he'd be treated like Julian Assange.
Like
he'd be treated like Kiriakou or Thomas Drake or, you know, any of the Bill Benny.
Yeah. What was I gonna say?
Well, and I think I think that the left is, so the way that I interact with the left on Twitter is kind of two minds. So there's this big mind about Medicare for all and fixing capitalism, or, you know, trying to get our way through this neoliberal nightmare that we're in. And that takes a lot of energy. And I get it. The CIA and these security issues haven't been real front and center for a lot of activists because, you know, I think a lot of activists kind of wash their hands of some of these whistleblowers wrongly. A while back, and I think it had to do with, you know, Hillary Clinton getting elected and, you know, the whole thing with the DNC and, you know, getting that blamed on Russia handing WikiLeaks a bunch of shit, and all of that is just it is so fabricated, it is so obviously fabricated, and I can't believe people actually buy it, but they do. I'm not saying that many people on the left, by the way. I think that on the left, there's a fatigue, and it's like there's not enough awareness. Like when something happens, like with Christie, and something happens, you know, and we reach a milestone with Julian Assange. I mean, we're going to come up on his hearing in February. That's going to come up fast because we're about in October. You know, once you get into holidays, things just fly by, and February is going to be here. And, you know, we have to be prepared for, you know, whatever happens from that. And you tweeted about this today. You said something about, should we go to London and should we be there to report on this? And I'm like, hell yes. So are you going to have like a GoFundMe or anything to try to raise money for that?
It's going to be one of those things where if we're testing the waters with it right now, if there's a clear response that yes, we should go be the U.S. media presence that is going to report on this accurately, then we will absolutely have to crowdfund it because we're broke asses. We also, like, it's basically just going to be, you know, the airfare. There's a YouTuber named Gordon Dimmick, who is a wonderful human being, has a fantastic show. I really can't say enough nice things about the guy, but he has offered to help us find places to crash while we're there so we don't have to pay hotel money or, you know, Airbnb or hostel money. we're going to do it as, you know, as cheap as humanly possible if it does in fact become a reality. I would like it to, just because the only comment that I saw on that poll that was in any way, shape, or form questioning what was going on is like, why would you guys, isn't Ruptly going to be there? Well, look, here's the thing. The only outlet in front of the embassy when Julian Assange was illegally dragged out to be thrown into the United Kingdom's Guantanamo Bay after being sold by the country of Ecuador, by this enabled President Moreno, for $4 billion from the IMF. After being sold, the only outlet on the scene was Ruptly, which is a subsidiary of RT, which is not an American outlet. There was no analysis to go along with that footage. There was just the footage with no additional information. And my response to that question would be, do you want to pin your hopes on the fact that maybe one outlet is there that will not provide any additional information, purely footage of what? Are they, you know, is Ruptly going to be allowed to bring a camera in? I don't think so. You're going to have to interview people. You're going to have interpersonal communication. And you're going to want an outlet there that is going to present to you what happened without intelligence community spin attached to it. So if we can be that outlet, fuck yes, we'll go. I'm sorry. Can I cuss on this? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's fine.
Okay.
I cuss on this all the time. And, okay. And you know, most of the time, it just comes out of my mouth,
like,
and I don't realize it.
Minutes without saying a swear word, Brooke. That's kind of, that's big.
Right? Well, I would contribute to that. I would totally contribute to that, because it's important to get Americans there to report from that subject position, you know, from that point of view. More Americans need to care about this, and especially people in journalism or journalism fanboys and girls. You know, if you're someone who appreciates being able to consume and interact with really good American journalism, you should really, really care about what happens with Julian Assange, because this could basically criminalize the business of journalism, even though most journalists now pretty much only see themselves as the catcher of the press releases from the PR flacks who make it go into the thingy. You know, they don't see themselves as the people who go out there and actually get news. They just take the news from whoever is giving it to them, and they don't ask questions, because that's how you keep your jobs.
Here's the thing. This isn't just journalists in the U.S. or journalists in the U.A. This is in the UK. This is, if you are a reporter, if you are an investigative journalist, or if you are someone who has acquiesced to being a stenographer to power, you need to be concerned about this, because Julian Assange is not an American citizen. He is an Australian citizen with a website that is not an American outlet, and yet the United States wants to extradite him to prosecute him under Espionage Act charges. As a publisher, this sets an incredible precedent that anyone around the globe that prints something the United States government doesn't want printed is subject to Espionage Act charges, where they will be brought to the U.S., thrown in a supermax or worse, and sentenced to, Julian Assange is facing up to 175 years. For
exposing
the crimes of empire.
Wow. So, you know, I have a confession to make. When WikiLeaks was publishing during the summer of 2016, you know, and, you know, there's all this stuff coming out about a DNC or whatever, you know, I found the political stuff to be pretty juicy, or, you know, like it was interesting, but it wasn't something that immediately when it came out, I did a search term on, you know, whatever that I was looking for. It just sort of, you know, it was something that you kind of meandered through and you're like, oh boy, there's a whole bunch of shit right there. You know, here's where they're,
right.
You know, tinkering around with this and trying to fix that. The email dump that I was most interested in was the Podesta emails, because I was dying to search on that Blink 182 guy and you know, search term UFO and search term UAP and all this stuff.
If Tom DeLonge isn't controlled opposition or there for the sole purpose of disinformation, I will come to your house and I will build you an addition and do it labor free.
Man, this is what I think it is. I think that there are factions, and I think that there are people who want to use some technology that has not been introduced to market yet because it's black technology. And I don't know if that's a black technology that was gleaned from, you know, some, you know, like Indiana. Yeah. like an Indiana Jones archaeological dig or something in Antarctica or whatever. You know, I don't know if it's that, or if I don't know if it's just the, hell, it could just be the march of science, and, you know, we just, you know, have gotten this far, but it's been black budgeted the whole time. I think there's some real technology there that somebody wants to get to market. I think that's the bottom line. They want to sell some shit.
I mean, yeah, what, to the extent of what they want to sell, I guess is only determined by one's imagination. There's a you know, full community of people who believe that disclosure is to prep the global consciousness for an invasion scenario that will usher in that one world government. And whether that's something to be laughed at or considered is going to have to be up to your listener. I take
a really kind of a different view to this. Like, you know, when I was in college and people first started talking about New World Order during Poppy Bush's administration, happened to also be the same time that I was a model UN, I was a competitive model UN Security Council freaking nerd. and so, you know, to do that, you learn about the United Nations and you learn about, like, you know, why that came together and how it came together. And to me, I'm sort of like, you know, they kind of already, I mean, it really, like this week is the United Nations General Assembly, their GA. I mean, if you were an Occupy person, there was the GA, the General Assembly. And, you know, it makes sense that the world would coordinate some of what they do. But, you know, that's if there were a scenario where these Tic Tac UFOs, or the one I personally want to see is the sphere with the cube inside of it. Like, I feel like that's that would be peak UFO sighting. If that's technology A that we have, that's pretty earth shattering. And if it's technology that we don't have that is messing with us, that's pretty earth shattering. And I think either way, there are plenty of people within private groups surrounding the government that are consultants and stuff that are trying to figure out what to do with that, you know, because that those are some pretty big hammers one way or another. That could either, you know, trigger another arms race or technology race, or, you know, oh my God, Stormship Troopers, we're going to war with the spider people or something crazy kind of shit. You know, I mean, this is time wave zero kind of Terrence McKenna territory. Like, we could just wander into.
So why not? You know, I'm doing my part.
I had just taken a drink of water when you said that. Oh, and that was almost a spit take. All right.
That's a little bit further afield than I thought we were going to go this evening, Brooke. That's awesome.
Well, that's what happens about this time of night. Like, and actually, that's completely true. About this time of night, I unplug, or I try to unplug from politics. And generally what I plug into is just, you know, the weird shit, you know, just, you know, I want the 100% concentrated weirdest shit I can find on YouTube. It's very important to me, you know, and some, like, I don't know, meditation thrown in, that kind of thing. But,
Whatever you do, do not listen to the guy by the Daleks.
The what?
You ever watch Doctor Who?
No.
Okay, then it would be entirely lost on you. but yeah, it's horrifying. that's cool though. Have you ever checked out Sam Tripoli's show?
I have, and I've gone and listened to all kinds of archives of his show. It's a treasure trove. And you know what's fun about that show too, is that not only do they talk about all kinds of weird shit for a good long time, where you can really like get into it, but it's interesting people having an interesting conversation. You know what I mean?
Cool. Yeah, and you like, get to find out. You get to find out real quick about, you know, Sam's sexual past too, which is something I wanted to know.
it's more than some bargain for, you know, you're not going to hear about.
It's a great show. It's called the Tinfoil Hat Podcast. I first became aware of Sam when I saw Jimmy Dore show, I guess 2 years ago now. And he was, you know, he was Sammy, and he was being freaking crazy. And he was like, I called the show the Tinfoil Hat Podcast because I sat there and I watched this election get rigged and this primary get stolen from this guy. And I would talk about it, and people would tell me that I was wearing a tinfoil hat. And so I decided to just roll with it. And he's known like Alex Jones and Eddie Bravo and Rogan and freaking Ari Shaffir and Brian Redman from like way back in the day. And he's been a fixture at the Comedy Store in LA for like 20 years. And has an underground comedy club in the upstairs of the Sycamore Tavern in LA that is host to Ron Pone, Graham Elwood. They have shows there. Jimmy Dore has done shows there. I don't know why I'm plugging the Sycamore. I don't even live in LA. but
we take advertising. You know, the Sycamore can advertise on the PNN anytime. Send us, as a matter of fact, just send us promos. We'll just run them. That's what we'll do. I used to see him on Jimmy Dore, and I didn't kind of, it didn't click with me at the time that he was into this other kind of weirdo stuff that I like. And, you know, I just kind of thought of him as a underground comic, not a, not kind of a off the wall or whatever. Yeah, like we were talking about this not too long ago, though, that, you know, when you come from the having listened to Art Bell back in the day, you know, as as entertainment. I mean, oh my God, that was such an that show was so entertaining that you would stay up late to catch what you could of it, you know, and people found clever ways to record it. We used to record it on our VCR. So because a VCR would go for like 3 hours.
Okay. My my buddy Kurt Vader, who was several years older than me, he would stay up, and he was a great bed taper. So he bought Maxell 90s by the case. and he would stay up and tape them, and then you know, we'd run into him the next afternoon. We were picking up Coast to Coast tapes like they were little dime bags of weed. It was great.
Oh man, that would have value to me. Back in the day, that would have had so much value to me. And as a matter of fact, there are episodes that I would love to hear again. Like there was a.
You can hear every episode of Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on YouTube.
Wow, I need to dig into that, because there were some obscure things that he got into back when, you know, back in the classic days and stuff. And yeah, I can't listen to George Norrie. I'm sorry, but
George
like,
Snorri?
Oh, he's so terrible.
You don't love George Snorri?
I feel like he's like a born again Christian, or like he's like he's getting ready to like lay some weird shit down, but he forgets or something.
His FBI handler won't let him.
Yeah. He just creeps me out. I don't like him at all. But
I wasn't even a fan when he was guesting on the show.
Mm-hmm.
But I know Art Bell will always have a very, very special place in my heart. I have more than once credited Clean LSD and Art Bell to me never trusting authority or my own government ever once, not even a little bit. So
that'll do it. That will do it.
But yeah, it's, yeah, you can dig through all of those episodes. It's great. I would recommend Sam's show, and I would also, recommend you check out some episodes of Duncan Trussell's show.
I subscribe to Duncan Trussell.
Okay.
I love Duncan Trussell. I think that I have known so many Duncan Trussells like in my life. Like listening to him is so familiar. It's like I he's pieces of five different people that I've hung out with doing drugs. You know?
Uh-huh.
They just kind of coalesce into this one person. And he does a fantastic show.
To get him to come up and play this comedy club that opened in Santa Cruz not too long ago. It'll be great. You'll see.
You guys need to tour. Just put together a tour and come to Orlando. We are starved for culture down here. I know that sounds terrible.
I've not heard great things about doing comedy in Florida. I really
haven't. There really isn't a scene. There tries to be a scene, and there are some really good, like small, like coffee houses, right? That do that kind of thing and do all kinds of really cool kind of spoken word stuff. And there's Will's Pub. Will's Pub is legendary and is the place to go see, you know, good rock and roll, and it's, you know, totally legit. And they have this like side room where they do other things. So there's some things that happen, but it's not, you don't have a scene, you know? So like the bigger clubs, every time I walk into like a big, like comedy club, like a, you know, like they're trying to, that's all they do. I feel like it feels to me like walking into a strip club. I don't know why. It's just me. Maybe nobody else gets that vibe, but it's, like comedy clubs, like Zany's in Nashville, always felt like walking into a, as my ex-husband would say, a titty bar.
Right. My favorite my favorite descriptions of just comedy in the South in general come from Bill Hicks's UFO tour album.
Yeah, is there anything better? I love running into people who are Bill Hicks naive, and you can turn them on. You can be like, oh, here's philosophy, or, you know, whatever, you know, CD that I have left that isn't totally scratched to pieces.
I got to do that today.
No.
I did. There's a wonderful lady in Australia who watches the vigils and has been a dedicated Julian Assange activist on his behalf for a few years and watches my show I guess occasionally because she was like, you mentioned Bill Hicks, and I've heard of them, but I haven't really heard them. What would you recommend? So, boom, here's Positive Drugstore. After listening to that, here's this, like, you know, 4-minute bit on marketing, and then here's the link to Revelations. But there's also Sane Man, like Brantney Minor. I am a fan. I am. He's the one true God. Our Lord and Savior, Brother Bill Hicks.
You know what I loved about Bill Hicks, among just everything. But I mean, everything there is to love about Bill Hicks. But I really appreciate the way that he so intensely, like unironically. He was enthusiastic about trying to describe his experience doing mushrooms and meeting the UFO from Arcturus.
Right.
and he's so descriptive. He's like the sky ripped like a sheet in two, and out came, and I'm like, I know, right? That'll happen.
Was 100% a genuine article. He really did like leave it all out there, and what it was almost like he was a troubadour, right? Like in the truest sense of the word. And it turned like you come to find out like he did all the guitar work on a couple of his albums, and he was in fact a musician. And the way that he had a not necessarily musical delivery, right? But there was that style of art, his bits were almost like pieces of epic songs. His whole approach was, there's nobody that's done that, because you can't.
Yeah, right. Who was the guy with, I'm forgetting, oh, Dennis Leary. Dennis Leary did that album, No Cure for Cancer, and totally ripped him off, along with the music and everything. And, you know, I mean, if it wasn't for ripping him off, I mean, like, if Leary had been doing his own stuff, it would have been interesting. You know what I mean? Like it was like, why ape what? Anyway. Why ape the master?
Because it was way funnier than anything Dennis had written, apparently.
It was a good record.
If you watch the mashup of Bill Hicks versus Dennis Leary, and you see the time and the date of Bill Hicks performing the routine, and then Dennis Leary doing damn near word for word the same bit.
Mm-hmm.
8 months later, a year and a half later, 2 years later, you know, it's like, oh, this is bad. I mean, and then it makes you question, like, was Jon Stewart a joke thief too? Because they're best buddies, according to both of them. And like, they had to, you know, Jon had to know.
Mm-hmm.
And getting big in comedy, like joke thieves are rewarded. This is just historical fact. But Robin Williams was a notorious joke thief. Carlos Mencia, notorious joke thief.
Well, I know about Carlos Mencia, but Robin Williams?
People would get up and they would intentionally screw up their set if they saw Robin Williams walk into the store.
Oh, my God.
Or
oh, my God.
What is it up in San Francisco? Cobbs, I think.
Oh my God! Well, God rest his soul, but that's untrue, man.
I mean, it's just notorious for it. Like, and then you'd have comics either walk off stage, or intentionally screw up, because they're like, not this time, yo.
Wow.
So
it'd be so cool.
It's not my fault. He's a joke thief. Okay, just want everybody to remember that. I didn't steal jokes and give them to Robin Williams.
Comedy world problems, man. I would love to live in a place where there's so much of a scene that material is getting stolen. Like, I think that for me would be like that's cool. But I mean, it sucks for the people like embroiled in it or whatever. But I wanted to ask you about one other thing, just because, oh my God, I didn't expect this to blow up today, but it blew up today. What are your thoughts, or did you talk about this at all on a stream that I didn't catch today, about this dust up with Elizabeth Warren and Medicare for All, you know, and her being like, well, it's really just a framework and there's a North Star or something that's guiding us, but Medicare for All is the guiding star. And there's it seems to me like today has been a weird big explosion, re-explosion of Medicare for All stuff. Like,
well,
all of a sudden, there was
that
and Tulsi.
Yeah, Tulsi Gabbard being completely unable to say straightforward, yes, support Medicare for All. She went off on a couple of different riffs of what her vision of healthcare looked like, and it was not, yes, I support Medicare for All. And that touched off a war in, you know, quote unquote progressive media between content creators, one of whom is a very vocal, avid, in fact admitted on my show, surrogate for Tulsi. I'm talking about Nico House.
Yeah, and he had some criticism he had some thoughts to share.
Nico was all about how just because she's not for Medicare for All doesn't mean she's not for Medicare for All, and look, Elizabeth Warren knows that Bernie Sanders has a 100-page document that is Medicare for All, and it is it has the words "to be determined" in it in several places, but those are the places that expand on the framework. You know what I mean?
Talk about stealing material.
They're not vague notions of things to be determined about. This is how the policy is implemented. This is what happens when this happens. This is what happens when that happens. It is I got a headache reading it.
Mm-hmm.
Elizabeth Warren has created this template of how to be progressive and sell it, and it has become a template that has been expanded on or tweaked depending on what other angle a particular candidate is going for, while being a fake progressive and consistently siding with Empire or deferring to caucus leadership or, you know, voting to just recently give the CIA near blanket immediately free immunity from even the most lower level employees in terms of being shielded by the press, or voting for the anti-BDS bill. Elizabeth Warren will talk a fantastic game. And she's got ready-made sound bites that I've had a guest on my show break this down, come from a Hollywood screenwriting factory or scriptwriting
really?
Factory that provides the DNC. The office is contracted through or contracted by the DNC to create content for them, to write for
no.
them.
No! No!
The guy that I interviewed, Carlos Chiara, he was part of the team that wrote four vice presidential acceptance speeches in 2016 for Hillary Clinton. And I can't remember the freaking fourth, but the three that I can were Elizabeth Warren, Tim Kaine, and Andrew Gillum. And they
my God.
Going into the convention ahead of the convention. So I'm sure so they could be dangled in front of prospective VPs. But that's why, and I would be incredibly surprised if the GOP didn't have something like that too. I just be honest, like I'm not trying to single out the Democratic Party here. I'm talking about it because I had a guy on my show who worked and did this on their behalf, or at least on their dime. But Elizabeth Warren will soundbite like crazy, and it sounds killer. She can introduce legislation that she knows has no chance of passing whatsoever that is more progressive in tone than the legislation that she will introduce or co-sponsor when, for example, the Democrats had a majority. She is 100% in favor of the same neoliberal means testing failed policy that has just wrecked every public institution that we have and helped destroy some more collective bargaining powers. Her concept.
Let's break out means testing too, because this is something I don't think that people think about. Like, I come from a background where I was means tested all the time. So, like, I was in CETA program and JTPA, and we had AFDC, you know, like, that's what it was like growing up poor at a certain time. There were programs that were means tested that you participated in or you didn't. Commodity foods was another one. What that did, this means testing thing, was real stigmatizing, you know, and it also made for it on the one hand it was stigmatizing because it was, you know, okay, these are the poor kids getting jobs or the poor kids poor families getting food or whatever. It also made it so that there was envy. You know, and this is what we do with Medicaid right now, by the way. So because Medicaid is means tested outside of the working poor and outside of people who are working and can't access access fucking healthcare. I hate that word. It creates these tiers, and it seems almost designed to create animosity between groups.
Right.
Which Absolutely. Is why they didn't do it with Social Security. Social Security isn't means tested because if it's not a right, then at some point, you know, the bullies will come along and they'll try to get rid of it.
Yeah, I agree with that. I do. The town that I grew up in, Anderson, Indiana, had implemented means testing G's.
Jeez.
I think it was like the late 80s when they got around to it, but you're right. All did, or at least in terms of like who got to go to what school.
And right.
What percentage of pepper was added to the salt, as it were. And the animosity that people would have when they would go have thrown at them when they would go back to their own neighborhood to come home from school. Oh, I mean, it was just, it was brutal, and it was dumb, and it was cruel. And this is the exact thinking that Elizabeth Warren applies to every single piece of domestic policy that she has taken from Bernie, ran through a soul-rendering process, and made sure that it completely benefits the exact people who have always benefited when this kind of garbage gets implemented into a...
No, did we lose you?
Huh? No, I'm here.
Oh, there you are.
That was all one breath, and I needed to find some air.
Yeah, so it's a Moynihan approach, you know. It's that 70s, late 70s approach where, you know, everything had to be, you know, you had to be sufficiently poor, and you had to be sufficiently, you had to sufficiently genuflect and do all the right things and file all the right this and that. And it's miserable. And it's exactly what people hate about that kind of programming. I mean, Elizabeth Warren, I think to me, what I find most troubling is that she is getting the support of the elites in the party and the elites in the media and just the elites everywhere. Oh, the Queer Eye guy even, you know, like went all in for Warren today. He's getting all of this, or she's getting all of this, like, manufactured in Hollywood buzz. And she's exactly the kind of Democrat that, you know, since McGovern, you know, we've tried not to run, you know?
It's
God, when
true.
You think about it, she is real McGoverny, isn't she? That's the kind of things that she's asking for.
She was a Republican
through
the Reagan years and didn't see anything wrong with that. She realized that it was more politically expedient for her to be a Democrat if she was going to run for office in Massachusetts. And that's maybe the defining characteristic of Elizabeth Warren, is that she is a political windsock who will do whatever is most expedient, guaranteeing that she will also back empire every single time. If you go and listen to her APAC speeches, you would think they were written by Ben Shapiro. They are brutal.
Wow. So Elizabeth Warren became a Democrat, what, in 1996?
Yeah, 94, 96, something like that.
So essentially, she saw Bill Clinton and was like, oh, that's what I want? That's the party that I'm all into?
Like the second time around, though.
Yeah, the so bad Bill Clinton.
The Massachusetts Republican, maybe I should check this before I make a statement. This is declarative. But let's see when Mitt Romney was governor. Of Massachusetts. 2003 to 2007. No, this is pre-Mittens. Wow. The Massachusetts Republican at that time especially coming out of 12 years of rule by George H.W. Bush, was an endangered species. You know?
Yeah, right.
And to be fair, 1994 was the year of the Newt Gingrich and the moral majority and Contract for America. That's when all of that went down, and Newt Gingrich is just such an egregiously horrible figure that I think if you were a politically expedient up-and-comer, you would immediately declare yourself no longer a member of that party.
Well, and I'm thinking, did this start, did she become a Democrat before or after, like, when did the Monica Lewinsky thing happen? And
that was much later. That was 97 when the Star Report.
97, 98. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't based on Bill Clinton's philandering at all. Again, this is just it. And Bill Clinton was, 100% marketed as, you know, the next Kennedy.
Uh-huh.
And is, or at least was, he's looking a little rough now, but, you know, late 80s, early 90s, you know, had the very, very charming, very, very, like, country bumpkin, handsome kind of dude. And he had a lot of people fooled for a long time. He's still got people fooled.
Mm-hmm.
Who just refuse to believe anything about the, or are willing to excuse away anything about the guy. It is, almost like
I am actually ashamed of some of the things that I, of the ways that I made excuses for Bill Clinton in the 90s, actually throughout the 90s, but especially during, you know, the later part, because that's also when he happened to be, you know, we had done the Telecommunications Act, which gave us, you know, monopolies, and we'd done, you know, all of the really, really bad stuff, and really the last thing that was left was
done the Crime Act, repealed Glass-Steagall.
Exactly.
There's the freaking, Iraq sanctions, Somalia, there's Yugoslavia. I mean, there's so many things that was terrible.
Well, listen, we've got just a few minutes. I scheduled 90 minutes for the show. So I wanted to make sure that here at the end, last couple of minutes, you had a chance to give people where they can find you at, because you're doing so much stuff right now.
Well, thank you. If you're just hearing me for the first time again, my name is Steve Poikkanen. I host a show called Slow News Day. You can find that on YouTube at youtube.com/slownewsdaypodcast. And you can find me on Twitter at Slow News Day Show. I also co-host the weekly Free Assange Vigil on the Action Number 4 Assange YouTube channel. They are on Twitter at Action for Assange, or underscore, Action underscore for Assange. We, on that show, it is, you know, updates on whistleblowers. We have incredible guests, and bring all of the news and calls to action and rallies and protest events globally that are going on. On my show, I do whatever I can to report my news from independent media outlets. And I mean truly independent media outlets, not like Vox, which is owned by NBC and Comcast. I interview the journalists that write for the outlets that I give you the news from, and that's about it.
Cool. Well, with that, we're going to have to sign off. The broadcast has timed out, but we'll still be recording for the podcast. Everybody catch Slow News Day at Slow News Day Show on Twitter. And I'm Brooke Hines, Nashville Brooke, and we'll be seeing you guys again real soon. And thanks you so much, Steve. This is amazing. Fun talk.
Thank you.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right. Cheers.